Ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please.
For the record, Justice Edmund Hillis on behalf of the defendant below, Bruce Wood. This is a case that involved two separate incidences that gave rise to charges of sexual assault, both of them against minors. In the first case, the conduct occurred between September 1st of 1996 and June 30th of 1998. And in the second set of charges, there was a conduct alleged from March 26, 2000 to March 25th, 2005. One set of charges had originally been indicted independently, and a re-indictment occurred that joined the two offenses in one charging document. The defendant filed a timely motion to sever the charges as to the two separate incidences, two separate complaining witnesses. A hearing was conducted in the Superior Court on a general motions calendar, and the judge heard argument and factual representations from both the state and the defense, and decided ultimately that there was sufficient similarity between the acts that they were properly joined. Now, the similarity all along from a factual point of view has been, and this is what the presentation made to the Superior Court judge who heard the motion was, that there was a mask involved in both incidences. Now, there are other similarities, to be sure. They are, indeed, the nature of the offenses, and I think
let's be more specific about that. There were how many counts altogether?
There were 9 counts with regard to the first in time, and there were 11 with regard to the second in time.
And how many of those counts involved the allegation of a mask?
The second set of charges, the mask was, I would say, the evidence as it came in demonstrated a factor in a lot of the time. This was supposedly an ongoing, almost daily occurrence. There was the complaining witness in that case described a procedure known as, the events as being following a procedure. And the procedure, as this progressed through time, began to include the use of the mask. With the other incident that occurred earlier in time, there is only evidence that a mask was used on one occasion, is my recollection, and it had to do with that child having a blindfold sort of thing. The word used is mask. I think what we're talking about is more of a blindfold.
Well, you're talking about the facts that were developed at trial.
Yes.
What was represented to the court at the time the motion was heard?
Well, it was a pretty general representation that there was a mask used in both series. And to be honest with the court, at that point, the state of discovery, and this is not an implication that the state hadn't complied with Rule 16, but the state of discovery was such that I wasn't in a position to factually challenge at that point. This is obviously a very fact-sensitive thing, and I think this court has the advantage of having been informed by the fact that they came in, whereas the motion decider didn't have that benefit. He was relying on representations made by the state. And again, I don't challenge.
But that motion decider did offer an opportunity for counsel to make further submissions.
He did, Your Honor, and we did not, either side. And I think if one looks to the Superior Court judge's decision in that, he even indicates that he thought it was highly unlikely, but he would give us the opportunity. To the extent that, well, the state has not made a claim of waiver, to the extent the court's concerned about waiver, I would point out that.
I didn't ask you that question for waiver. I was, in my own mind anyway, following up on Justice Risley's question about what were the facts that established the similarity between the first stage of offenses, as I understand the record, 2 years later, a second stage of offenses that resulted in a combined trial. When the motion to sever was denied and joinder ultimately occurred, what were the facts then known to the court that would create a basis to deny the motion to sever or to allow joinder of the offenses?
The facts were these, Your Honor, that they were similar offenses in that young children who were placed in the care of the defendant were involved. They were similar in that the victims of each offense were taken apart from others so that there would be privacy. And that I think the fact that doors were locked in both instances, and then the mask. That's the general factual proposition that was presented to the court. What we suggest to the court, however, is that there is not such a signature element to the use of the mask and the private, I don't want to use the word secreting, the disassociation of the victim from others is a rather common occurrence in this type of offense. It's part of what happens in these types of offenses.
Well, let's go back to what the motion judge knew. And as I understand your answer to Justice Ridgely's question, there were two separate victims.
Yes, sir.
And there was a two-year gap.
Yes, sir.
And if the motion judge was reading the indictment with regard to the first victim, there are nine counts with a mask allegedly used once. After the two-year hiatus, we have a second victim with a mask or blindfold used multiple times.
Correct. And I'd also point out, Your Honor, that both instances covered large time periods. The indictment was framed, as is often true in these cases, based upon broad time periods. I think in one case by month, and in another case it may have been even longer periods.
So your application to the court was, especially given the two-year gap and this connection of the blindfold being tenuous from your point of view.
Yes, sir.
Putting aside the general nature of the offenses, which would have been committed in a similar way just by the nature of the offenses.
Yes, sir.
That these were really standalone offenses, and that the joinder, the prejudicial effect of the joinder, outweighed any benefit of combining them. Is that
right? That's exactly the argument that was made. And I will note that I wasn't, again, in a position then, based on the facts that were known to me, to draw that distinction about the one-time use and the multiple use. Those facts became developed much later and fully developed during the trial.
Right, but we're trying to, in this appeal,
yes, sir,
decide whether the motion to sever should have been granted based on information that was available to the judge who decided the motion.
Understood. And my argument was as the court has characterized it.
Okay. Well, can you expand for a moment on what you perceived to be the prejudice at that time of not severing the trials or of joinder?
The joinder prejudice, I believe, is the classic propensity problem that you have two separate sets of offenses. You have two vulnerable victims making complaints. And from a strategic point of view, I think it's why the re-indictment occurred. The state was seeking the advantage of these two stories bolstering one another. I mentioned in my filings with the court the idea that was cited by, I believe it was a Texas appellate court, that there's this notion that as the accusations grow, the probability of occurrence is there and can't be ignored, and that the real danger is that juries, as the ultimate fact finders, may go along that route. And I think the severance jurisprudence and the 404B jurisprudence is designed to prevent that danger. And here, I mean, I don't know how I can show the court, other than the instance of that, the fact that they actually found not guilty on two counts against the second complainant, that they're, you know, here's the prejudice. They found him guilty of both sets of offenses in what the defense has characterized in their briefing as two very different stories in terms of credibility.
Let's go back to the re-indictment. Help me understand the record. Was there one indictment because there was only one known victim, and then when the second victim became known, there was a re-indictment to put them together? Or were there two separate indictments that were then combined in a re-indictment?
Never two separate indictments.
There were.
There were not. I'm sorry. There was the indictment in the one case.
Right.
And then the indictment that involved the second incident. There was not two indictments on the second incident. So there's just an indictment and a re-indictment. The re-indictment brings in the second set of charges. However, those charges were actually pending under two different criminal identification numbers. And what that means is that there were charges initiated separately with regard to both sets of charges. The set of charges that did not get indicted first existed and was known to the state when they indicted the first set.
So they indicted for the later offenses first? Does it matter?
I don't think it matters, Your Honor, and I can't give you the answer, unfortunately, to that right now.
Now, why wouldn't the evidence, at least as to the mask or blindfold of both cases, be admissible in both trials, assuming there had been a severance?
Because I don't think the notion of modus operandi is more than similarity of offenses. All the case law suggests that modus operandi has to do with signature-type things, a path of conduct that is so similar and, if you will, idiosyncratic, that it surpasses the dangers associated with mere, what I will call in this case, not really signature similarity. Yes, a mask was used in both cases. Both victims are children. We know that doesn't mean anything. The offenses are similar in that they violate trust of an adult with a child, but I don't think that's enough. So the issue is, does this mask, and given the fact that it's used, I would suggest, very differently in both cases. In the latter set of charges, it's used as part of the procedure, which is the real grist of at least half of that series of conduct that's charged, if not more. And in the other case, it is used almost incidentally with regard to that child, and only, as the evidence showed, on the one occasion. That's my recollection of the evidence. I think it's borne out by the record. So there is, I believe, a qualitative and significant difference. And I would characterize it this way. In the second set, where the mask is part of the procedure, it's almost a ritualistic thing. Whereas in the first set of charges, the mask becomes a convenient tool that was there at that time. It has none of the ritualistic aspects that the second set of charges involved. As a matter of fact, the second set of charges is qualitatively different in that regard.
Was the type of mask similar in each?
There's not a lot of description other than, as I indicated to the court, I believe in both cases they said it was black. And I believe in both cases, while the term mask is used, it's more accurately described as a blindfold, as opposed to some kind of disguising, some kind of mask that makes you look like something other than a person. It was to shield the vision.
If there was a robbery case, which often can involve a mask,
mm-hmm.
And they were separated by the same time period, would the evidence of one robbery be admissible in the other robbery trial because of the similarity of the mask?
Given that alone, yes, I believe it would. But I think it seems to me that when you use a mask in a robbery, you're always using it the same way for the same reason.
Well, the mask isn't on the victim in a robbery.
And correct.
Isn't the purpose of that kind of, you use the term signature, element of the evidence to show the identity or suggest the identity of the perpetrator must be the same? The briefing argument seems to focus on the interesting concept that you find offensive, that one set of charges and the victim's testimony in that set used to bolster the credibility of the victim in the second set of charges. And that seems to be the very point the state makes to justify allowing the evidence to come in, because the state makes the point that, well, okay, modus operandi normally goes to identity. Identity's not an issue here. The real factor is who's telling the truth about what happened or whether anything happened. So it strikes me as something odd that I haven't been able to figure out yet, to be candid with you. You say the bolstering creates the propensity argument that gets prevents and causes the problem, and the state argues it's actually the solution. Indeed, we used one victim's testimony to bolster the other. That's how we got the conviction. It tends to show it's more likely that both victims were telling the truth when they can relate to similar incidences involving each other over a two-year time period. There's something wrong with this picture, and I haven't quite figured it out yet. Can you help out with that?
One way to solve the problem is perhaps simplistic, but it's that the state's wrong in this case, that there isn't a sufficient underlying similarity between the two events other than the kinds of offenses they are to justify the danger of the propensity argument. Inherent in an argument that one bolsters the other is to some degree propensity.
Well, let's follow up on that similarity point. You seem to suggest when Justice Ridgely asked about robberies, a mask in one robbery, a mask in another robbery, maybe you can get it in under Getz in a separate trial. Would your answer be the same if one robber wore a ski mask in the first robbery and in the second robbery wore a Halloween mask?
I think that's qualitatively different.
So is that the point you're trying to make here, that
that
there weren't sufficient similarities?
Yes, that is. I think you've correctly gotten the point that the appellant is trying to make.
I don't want to cut off your answer to Justice Holland's question and continue if you wish, but you're in your rebuttal. Did you want to save it?
Yes, I would like to save it at this point. Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Elizabeth McFarlane on behalf of the state. This is a case of a child molester who abused two victims over a length of time, both over a length of time, and whether or not these charges should have been severed. The charges against Mr. Wood involved his actions against young children. They were young female children. He began by abusing his neighbor's child when she was supposed to be in his care. He isolated her from the other children. He tricked her using a blindfold, a black blindfold, and convinced and bribed her with ice cream and convinced her that she would be pretty if she drank his semen. This continued, this isolation, and from the other children for a great length of time, and ended only when he no longer had access to the child. When he moved on to his next girlfriend, who had a child similar age, female, he started all over again. He isolated her. He tricked her into performing a procedure, saying it was her fault that she had injured him and this was the only way that she could make him better, that she had to fix it. He continued with this abuse for years. Coincidentally, they both reported late, within 10 days of each other. These reports came in through separate police agencies. The intakes were done through different agencies, which would explain the initial separate single indictment on the one. Once the office became aware of the two similar situations, there was a re-indictment, and all the charges were put on a single indictment.
And why did you want the charges combined?
Well, they were of a similar nature, and thus one could combine. It would certainly strengthen the case.
Because you were hoping the jury would use the evidence from one case to give credibility to the other case and vice versa.
There is always, in these types of cases, particularly in late reporting cases, there is little or no physical evidence that the sexual abuse occurred. The fact that two victims who did not associate with each other, had no contact in many years, both describe similar acts by the same person.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting.
That would be the reason.
Right. I'm not suggesting if you would have simply said yes, and that was a negative answer. In fact, that's what the state wanted to do.
Certainly.
You wanted to demonstrate to the jury that this person was credible because, in fact, you had a second person who was going to talk about the defendant doing, in your view, similar things to her.
Certainly. At the motion hearing.
Tell us why that wasn't unduly prejudicial to the defendant.
Well, in this case, there were distinct similarities of age of victim, sex of victim, the age differential, the fact that they both had to watch pornography. They saw videos as well as magazine pornography. Defendant used the pornography to groom his victims, to teach them how to do procedures, the length of the abuse, and the isolation of the victims all tended to show the same types of behaviors. These were certainly the similar acts were charged, which makes it proper to join them, and he has demonstrated, certainly there's always some prejudice when you have a large number of charges in any indictment.
The reason you want them together is because you want to prejudice the defendant in a proper way.
And
that's why my question to you, using the standard of appellate review or the standard at the trial court, why was the prejudice unfair? Or why did the prejudice why didn't the prejudice to the defendant outweigh the state's interest in joining them? And your answer is certainly they were prejudicial, that was your purpose, but it wasn't unfair.
That's correct. These charges naturally flowed in that they were of the same type with the same defendant, and it was not like joining a sexual assault case with a robbery where you could see there might be some, if people were horrified by sexual assault, that then, oh, well, he must be a robber too. These were the same or similar nature, the crimes, which is one of the...
Can we parse the facts? You say that, and that apparently is what happened when the Superior Court acted on the motion. But what Mr. Hillis tells us is, with regard to the first victim, in 9 counts, the mask was involved once. Many times the mask was involved with regard to the 11 accounts and the second victim. Now, you've told us these similarities of showing pornographic material or pornographic movies. If we compared the 9 counts in one and the 11 counts in the second, and we look at the mask as a common denominator, Mr. Hillis tells us they only overlap once. With regard to all of these other similarities you've described, do you have a familiarity with the record to tell us the nature of the overlap?
First of all, the nature of the overlap with the blindfold, I've read the record differently than my colleague. And, in fact, in full candor to the court, the blindfold was not used extensively in either situation. It was not, in fact, part of the procedure. It was used more than once with the later reporting victim, but it was not a regular, it was not part of the original procedure that she was tricked into doing. In terms of...
Well, the court appreciates that clarification.
In terms of pornography, both victims reported repeatedly seeing pornography and videos and magazines, and that was common throughout. The isolation behind locked doors was common throughout.
Now, let me just add a qualification. Going back to what the judge ruling on the motion would have known, what similarities would have been known to the judge who denied the motion to sever when the judge said, look, close enough for joinder from my point of view?
The prosecutor brought up the pornography, the trickery, the age and sex of the victims, the length of abuse, the age variance, the caretaker role that's in State's Appendix B 3 through 9. The prosecutor listed numerous similarities.
Can you help me address the relationship, if any, between Rule 403 and the rules addressing severance? So if there were separate indictments and the information on the blindfold or any other aspects of one case not on trial was sought to be introduced, there'd be an objection and a 403 analysis. You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. When there's a motion to sever, when they are indicted together, is there a same 403 analysis or is it a different analysis? And the reason I'm asking that is this is the indictment, joining in one indictment, a way to circumvent the 403 analysis or not?
Well, Rule 8A allows the joinder of same or similar types of offenses, flat out. Then it becomes a question of prejudice, whether there's substantial unfair prejudice to the defendant. So in that sense, you're still doing an analysis in terms of whether something is prejudicial or not. So it's not actually circumventing. But the burden is different in that once offenses are properly joined under Rule 8, then it becomes the defendant's burden to show there is a substantial prejudice.
Which is different than probative value being substantially outweighed.
Yes, so there is a slight difference. The burden shifts. Once they've been properly joined, the burden then shifts to show that there's a risk or a not just a risk, there's a probability of substantial prejudice to the defendant by the joinder of those offenses.
Once the offenses are joined, and let's assume for the purpose of my question that the motion to sever was properly denied, the two incidents were properly joined in one indictment and properly tried in one indictment. What role, if any, does a Getz analysis play when the jury hears these two separate incidents in one trial?
Well, Getz applies to uncharged conduct. So Getz does not really apply at all in this case. It would be very difficult for the court to instruct, for example, the jury not to consider the evidence except for a certain way when you're talking about substantive charges. They are supposed to consider that evidence.
So the argument then follows necessarily that once they're joined, if they are similar transactions, we no longer should worry about whether if the jury, in considering them each individually, each charge in the indictment individually, across the span of two transactions separated by 2 years, you are suggesting, both in your brief and today, should no longer be concerned about any propensity argument. The jury shouldn't be told that the mere fact that the defendant's been charged over a two-year expanse of time with similar transactions, if you find him guilty of the earlier transactions, you should infer nothing about whether or not he's guilty of the second set of transactions. They're just propensities out the window, propensities fair game. You could even argue to the jury that because you believe, perhaps beyond a reasonable doubt, he committed the first set of offenses, you should infer that he probably committed the second.
No, Your Honor.
Then tell me why Getz plays no role.
Because Getz talks about using uncharged conduct that the state is not trying to prove to show something at trial, as opposed to evidence that goes to a specific charge.
Okay.
The jury is instructed.
Well, let's assume you're correct. Getz is simply uncharged crimes. Now that they're charged crimes, to avoid prejudice, is the defendant entitled to an instruction that cautions the jury that you're going to consider each of these charges independently? They're two different sets separated by 2 years. Should you find him guilty of all of the charges in the first transaction, let's call it for lack of a better term,
You shouldn't infer from that that he's probably guilty of the second. You have to approach each of those independently as well and find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Is it in order to avoid the same type of problem that Getz announces to us, do you inform the jury to avoid that danger, or do you just let them use propensity as an artful tool to find a conviction?
Well, Your Honor, they are given an instruction, and they were given that instruction in this case, to consider each offense separately and to only consider each charge as a separate offense. And that is the instruction that is appropriate and given in cases where there are multiple offenses.
Okay, so the answer is we shouldn't be concerned if there was or was not a cautionary instruction because there's no need for it. The final instructions cover the issue.
That would be correct.
Okay.
Well, does the state normally argue to the jury, you should believe victim number two because it's consistent with what you heard from victim number one and vice versa?
No. The state would not argue that you should infer that the second, you know, that some witness is credible because another witness is credible. That would not.
Isn't that what your brief suggests?
No, the brief is suggesting that courts have found that if, in cases like this, where there is a late report and the only possible defense is that is a fabrication, recent fabrication, they're making it up, they're out to get me, that the fact that completely independent victims report a similar crime makes it more likely that a crime in fact occurred. That is different than saying, well, because we've alleged 15 charges, he must have a criminal disposition and therefore be guilty of everything. And in fact, in this case, the jury was hung. They did not actually acquit on the two charges. They were hung on two. And the jury sent four or five notes out asking questions and were repeatedly told to consider everything separately. And so it's clear in this case that ultimately the defendant was not prejudiced. The jury did carefully consider each separately. It was not a quick.
Can you address the temporal element? I assume your position is the two-year time lapse from one set of offenses to the other is okay. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years. When does this become a turning point in terms of the analysis?
I don't think there's a bright line rule. In this case, it was really a moving from one phase into another, changing girlfriends, changing his situation where he had access to a similar victim. If he had gone off and done something else entirely for several years and...
Let me ask you this one. I suppose the outer limit is 5 years because of the statute of limitations.
That would have a factor, be a factor in it.
And 5 years is okay?
I think it would depend on the case, but I don't see that there's some particular rule that says there's a cutoff other than and in this case the part of it was the, you know, coincidental fact that they reported at this within almost a week of each other. So in this case it is a question of abuse of discretion, and the trial judge who had the information in front of him about the similarities of these offenses and properly denied the motion to sever. Their defense counsel did not convince the judge that there was a probability that his client would be substantially prejudiced, and as such, the judgment below should be affirmed.
I want to ask one other question. In terms of the argument that the evidence of one trial in one trial would be admissible in the other, shouldn't, as part of that analysis, should a 403 analysis be conducted at that point or not? And was that done?
There was, I don't think that was done entirely. There was some discussion about it, but that would be appropriate at that point in time. Certainly, in fact, a Getz analysis as to whether one would come in another trial would be appropriate if that was the sole basis for the.
Wasn't that the sole basis for the trial judge's ruling here, that the evidence of one would be admissible in the other?
Well, he apparently looked at it and felt that way. That is not necessary. That is, if he finds that way, that is sufficient to deny the motion. However, that's not the only reason that's not necessary, in fact, to deny the motion to sever.
I thought you made the point that Getz only applied to uncharged crimes.
Well, but that would be in a separate trial. When they are actually tried together, one would not look at Getz because they are all charged.
Well, if these had been tried separately, would the evidence of the first trial be admissible in the second trial to show that the late reporting was understandable, that a crime actually occurred? Because guess what? Someone else had already reported it, and there have been convictions based on that, on a similar transaction in the past?
You would look at Getz, even though they'd been charged in a separate indictment. When I say uncharged, I mean uncharged in the indictment at that trial, not uncharged in general.
I follow you now. Thank you.
Are there no further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to, with the time I have remaining, first address the what appears to be a difference between counsel for the state and myself with regard to whether or not the mask was part of the procedure. It was not part of the procedure per se. Factually, the procedure was actually written out about what would be done. It became, as we progressed through time, part of performing the procedure, as, for want of a better term, an addendum to the original procedure. The procedure was supposedly developed by a doctor to help eradicate some pain that the state's evidence says he used that as a persuasive tool to engage that person in the sex act with him. Another dissimilarity between the two is the nature of the sexual acts. In the first case, there was oral sex.
Before we get to dissimilarities,
yes,
what the state tells us is, if we look at B3-9, the state had a list of five or six similarities that were made known to the motion judge when the motion to sever was denied. And the mask wasn't the central theme. So the question is, on an abuse of discretion standard, if the state is representing to the motion judge there are five or six similarities, what was your response at the time, that the nine counts and the 11 counts didn't overlap so that the similarities, you know, really weren't congruent? Or was it simply that the similarities are really differences rather than similarities?
The last part of your question is an interesting point. I can't say I argued that to the trial judge, although I think it may be expressive of where I was coming from in my argument, which was that the other characteristics the state argues are sort of inherent to the type of offense. I mean, the charged conduct was that he was in a position of authority over these people. That's going to be true in each case. And so can it be given some weight in the overall balancing? Yes, I believe it can. But I think that ultimately, when one determines, there's always the 403 test, whether we employ Getz or not. Any piece of evidence is subject to a balancing test on the 403. I think taking everything together here that...
But you can see what we're trying to get at with the questions from the court is... Is the 403 analysis really part of the equation when there's a proper joinder and a motion to sever has been denied? Because, as you know, someone commits 20 robberies and they're all joined together, there's going to be a lot of spillage, so to speak, for want of a better term, in what the jury's going to think. and you're not going to be doing a 403 analysis because it's all going to come in as a part of the charges. So here, once the motion to sever is denied, there's no gets analysis and there's no 403 analysis.
That's correct.
Because the evidence of each is coming before the jury. So the motion to sever becomes almost dispositive of how the trial is conducted.
I think that is exactly our point. And so that, but it is incumbent upon the defendant here, not so much as I read the standard of review here, to convince that trial judge. We do need to talk about potential prejudice there. But here, this court examines it in light of reasonable probability of substantial prejudice may have resulted from the joint trial. And that's where, if I go back to my beginning of my original argument, that's where this court is in a better position than the trial judge. Not because the trial judge didn't want that information, because it simply was not there. And the final thing I'll add is these investigations started without being connected, and at some point they were connected. And I'm going to suggest to the court that my understanding of the factual record is that the state was aware when they got the first indictment that the second set of charges existed. Prosecutors changed, and I think there was a change then in strategy. And so that's what led us to this. But I don't want the court to have the misapprehension that somehow all of a sudden they say, oh, there's this other set of charges. That there was a indicting decision on the one set when the state was already aware of the second set, and that Mr. Wood was, in fact, the prime suspect in both sets.
All right, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Take the case under advisement.